I can help you. Annie pulls back the sheet, and I swing my legs over the side, testing the firmness of the floor. She puts an arm around my waist, supporting me on the short walk to the ensuite. When did I get a private room? I don't remember getting here. Where's Jack? Sitting on the commode, I look at the bandages on my abdomen and recall the birth. I was conscious, but didn't feel a thing when Mr. Phillips made the incision. Jack was next to him, wearing a surgical mask and giving me a commentary, pretending to call the Grand National. Coming to the final turn, and Meg Shaughnessy is 3 lengths ahead of the field, making it look easy. She's approaching the last. Up and over, kicking for home. She's 5 lengths clear, make that 6. The crowd are on their feet. Listen to that roar! I wanted to kill him because he was making me laugh. And it's a boy, he said. Son of Shaughnessy, a champion in the making. I flush the toilet, and Annie helps me back to the bed. There's another knock on the door, the same nurse as before. She and Annie are whispering again, talking about me. What are they hiding? Annie comes back to the bed. Are you sure you're not hungry? I want to see Jack. We're trying to find him. My voice grows more strident. Where has he gone? What have you done to him? You must stay calm, Mrs. Shaughnessy, otherwise they'll sedate you. You don't want that, do you? She has an annoying, cloying voice like a kindergarten teacher telling a child that she's letting the class down. You'll feel better after a nice cup of tea. I don't want tea. I want Jack. Annie holds up her hands and says she'll ask. She leaves me alone in the room. Ignoring the pain, I get out of bed and search for my clothes, opening cupboards and drawers. I find a dressing gown and slippers. Where's my phone? Edging the door open, I peer left and right along the corridor, trying to get my bearings. I need to find a telephone. Jack will know what to do. I turn left and shuffle towards double doors. A nurse appears. I change direction and pass a maternity ward. I recognize this place. From somewhere nearby comes the sound of a baby crying. My heart leaps. They've found him. I follow the sound and push open a curtain. A woman is holding a newborn. That's my baby, I yell. Her eyes go wide, terrified by the sight of me. Give him back! He's mine! She hugs him tighter. I try to wrench him from her arms. Nurses come running. The PC is with them, her face flushed with anger or embarrassment. Let go, Mrs. Shaughnessy, says a nurse. It's not your baby. I'm sobbing into her shoulder. Not mine, I say, repeating the words as the memories coalesce, and I remember what happened. My baby is missing. Stolen. Snatched away. Why? Who would do such a thing? What if he's been dumped somewhere? What if he's been left on a doorstep or in a rubbish bin? He could be buried under leaves or locked in the boot of a car. People might be walking past him and not know. They might not hear him crying. Children get taken all the time. They wander off. They fall into swimming pools or get into strange cars or wander into the woods. But babies don't disappear. Babies don't follow kittens or fall asleep in garden sheds or get lost in shopping malls. Babies can't flag down passing cars or follow signs or knock on doors or phone home or ask strangers for help. Babies can't tell people that they're missing. Or find their way home, like lost dogs. Where is Jack? He should be here. I can hear myself yelling his name. Strong hands are holding me down. The hypodermic pricks my skin, and my mind slides and falls, tumbling into a chemical void. I fight the needle. I sleep. I dream. Agatha. Rory had a good night. He slept beside me in the double bed. I woke every half hour and put my hand on his chest, checking to make sure. I do not feel guilt or shame. My contrition has been overtaken by love. My sense of self has been erased. Rory is all that matters. I could lie next to him for the rest of my life, staring at his beautiful face, putting my forefinger into his little fist, or brushing my lips across his forehead, or listening to his fluttering heart. I whispered to him, "You are my fifth baby. Fifth time lucky. Five is my favorite number." The sun is up. I'm cradling Rory in my arms, looking in the mirror, picturing myself in the eyes of others. His head is a funny shape, a little squished on one side like a very cute alien. But that's likely to pass in a few days. Holding up my phone with one hand, I take photographs, selfies, smiling as though my face might break from happiness. The pictures are emailed to Jules and Hayden and Mr. Patel and my landlady and all of my friends. I tell them about the days since his birth, constructing a narrative, setting the timeline in people's minds and memories. When I came in last night, the front desk was empty. There were two teenage girls talking on the stairs, who paid little notice to a woman carrying a baby in a sling. I stepped around them and unlocked my door. Having showered and changed, I fed Rory and then turned on BBC News. There was no mention of a baby being taken. It was still too early. This morning, it's a different story. The screen shows a reporter standing outside the hospital, talking to the camera. I turn up the volume. "At this stage, details are scant, but police have confirmed that a woman posing as a nurse abducted a newborn baby from the Churchill Hospital in central London last night. The baby boy was only 10 hours old when taken from a maternity ward by a woman in nurse's uniform who claimed the newborn needed a blood test. The alarm was raised by the baby's father and the Churchill locked down, but the woman had already left the hospital." The footage switches to police cars parked in the street and detectives entering the doors. The name of the family has not been released, but police are appealing to the kidnapper to surrender the baby to police or medical services. Sources are also suggesting the newborn may need medical attention. "Rubbish," I say to Rory. "You're perfectly fine, aren't you? They are such worrywarts." Letting the TV play in the background, I warm up a bottle in a sink full of hot water. Rory doesn't seem to like the baby formula. Either that or he's not sucking strongly enough. When he latches onto my little finger, he seems to get the idea. But he turns his face away from the bottle after one or two sucks. I try for almost half an hour until he falls asleep. He'll be hungry later, I tell myself. I check the messages on my phone. Hayden has left most of them. I called last night and told him I'd be home today. I apologized for being out of touch, saying that my mobile had died and that I didn't have a charger. Now I sent him another message, saying that I'm on the train and should be home by midday. He tries to call me straight back, but I don't answer, letting it go to voicemail. "I could pick you up from the station," he says. "I'm staying at your flat. Your friend Jules let me in. I hope you don't mind. I can't wait to see you." I smile to myself. Fatherhood has already transformed him. He wants to see his son. He wants to see me. It's cold this morning. I dress Rory warmly and make sure his head is covered with a woolen hat. He opens his eyes fully when I'm changing his nappy. His arms and legs wave in the air as though he's frightened of being naked. The receptionist is back at the front desk. This time I put the baby carrier on the counter, letting her see Rory. She doesn't seem very interested. I make a comment about the weather, saying he'll get a shock when he goes outside. "Who?" "Rory." "Oh, he's only 3 days old," I say. "That's young to be travelling. We're going home. What about your boyfriend?" "I've forgiven him." I ask her to call me a minicab and wait in the warmth until I see the car pull up outside. The driver has to help me buckle the baby carrier into the back seat. I should have practiced. My clumsiness makes me look amateurish. "Where to, love?" he says, in an East End accent that sounds more like affectation than something born and bred. He's chatty and cheerful. The conversation jumps from the weather to Christmas crowds, and then his own children, three of them, 6, 8, and 11. "I prefer them as babies because they can't talk back," he says, glancing at me in the rearview mirror. Your little one looks straight out of the oven.
Pretty much.
Shouldn't you still be in hospital?
Not really.
He asks why I was staying in a hotel.
My parents own the place, I reply.
Good for them.
Now he thinks I'm rich. I mean, they manage the place. It's owned by some Russian guy.
The Russians are buying everything, he says. The oligarchs.
He makes oligarchs sound like aardvarks. We're circling Hammersmith roundabout and taking Fulham Palace Road. My mobile begins ringing. Hayden again.
Where are you?
Almost home. I'm in a minicab.
I'll meet you downstairs.
The driver glances in the mirror again.
Did you hear the news about that baby taken from the hospital?
No.
Yeah, last night. Someone snatched a little boy right out from under their noses.
Do they know who?
Someone dressed up as a nurse.
How awful. That poor mother. Does she have any other children?
Report didn't say.
Our eyes meet in the mirror.
I didn't mean to upset you, love.
I realize that I'm crying. I wipe my cheeks, apologizing. I'm sorry. It must be the hormones. I cried all the way through my pregnancy.
I'm a big softy as well, he says. Ever since I had a family, I can't read stories about kiddies being abducted or abused. Chokes me up every time. If someone hurt one of mine, I'd kill him. Forget about the police or the courts. They'd never find his body. Know what I'm saying?
I don't agree or disagree. He's warming to the subject.
That's why we need the death penalty in this country. Not for everyone. For paedophiles and terrorists.
We turn into my street. I see Hayden waiting on the steps. I'm barely out of the car when he scoops me into his arms.
Gently, I say, flinching. I've just had a baby.
I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm so stupid. He doesn't know where to put his hands. He tries his pockets first, front, back. Then he looks into the car. Seeing Rory, he opens his mouth in wonderment.
Say hello to your little boy, I tell him.
Hayden reaches out and touches Rory's cheek. His hand is bigger than Rory's head.
He won't break, I say.
But he's so small.
All babies are small, I laugh. You can carry him inside.
He lifts Rory out of the car while I pay the driver and wish him a Merry Christmas. Hooking a bag over my shoulder, I follow Hayden up the stairs. He's holding the carrier with both hands like it's a Ming vase. Once inside the flat, I shrug off my coat and notice the flowers. Two huge bouquets are bookending the mantelpiece.
Those arrived an hour ago, says Hayden, who can't seem to sit still.
One lot's from Mum and Dad and the other from Jules.
Where is Jules? I ask. I thought she'd be here.
She and Kevin have gone to Glasgow to see her folks.
When is she coming back?
Not for a few weeks. She tried to call you.
I know. I'm sorry. My mobile ran out of juice. I didn't have my charger.
Can you use another phone?
I didn't have your number or Jules's number. Like I said, my phone died.
Rory's carrier is on the coffee table. Hayden is staring at him.
Why did you run away like that?
I didn't run away. I had a premonition that I was going to have the baby early. That's why I went up north. I didn't want to be caught on my own.
But I wanted to be at the birth, he says, sounding hurt. I came all this way.
I know, but I got scared.
Scared?
It wasn't just the thought of having a baby, but of you being there. I thought you might not want to touch me again if you saw me go through childbirth. It was pretty gross stuff. I was sitting in a paddling pool, screaming my head off.
He puts his arms around me, and I lean into his chest, feeling his strength, smelling his smell.
I know it sounds stupid, I say, but I haven't seen you since the end of March. We've only spoken a few times on the satellite phone. I worried that you might have second thoughts if you saw me like that, perched on all fours, pushing a baby out.
Not likely, he says,
kissing my lips.
Lovely.
Rory lets out a mewling squeak as though missing out on the action.
Is he hungry? Asks Hayden.
No, he's just waking up. Would you like to hold him?
I might drop him.
No, you won't. I unbuckle Rory and lift him out of the carrier.
Hayden perches on the edge of the sofa, both feet on the floor, his back straight.
When you pick him up, you have to support his head, I say. Right now his neck isn't strong enough to hold his head, but he'll get stronger. Now rest him in the crook of your arm with your hand under his bottom. See? That's not so hard.
Hayden looks stiff and uncomfortable, but he's smiling like he's bending bananas with his face.
You can breathe, I say.
Sorry, I'm a bit nervous. Maybe you should take him back.
You're just getting to know him.
I'll hold him later. He hands Rory back, then wipes his palms on his jeans.
Do you like the name? I ask.
He nods.
How did you know?
Your father told me. He said Rory was your grandfather's middle name, and your father, and then you.
And now we have another Rory.
Do you like him?
He's the business.
Megan.
Megan? Megan? Are you awake?
The voice is slowly getting closer, filling my head. I try to open my eyes, but they seem to be glued shut. Wrestling my way through a haze of drugs, I try to take a hold on reality and make it solid. Images coalesce. Voices. Light. My eyes are wet. I have been crying in my sleep. A different police constable is sitting next to my bed. She's leaning forward as though I've said something that she didn't quite catch. I open my mouth, but my lips are dry. I try again.
My baby.
She hands me a cup with a closed lid and a straw. Water. I empty it completely. My voice works.
Has there been any news?
Not yet, says the PC.
Who are you?
I'm PC Sousa. Please call me Lisa Jane.
She has green eyes and blonde hair with a fringe that keeps falling across her forehead. She brushes it back behind her left ear.
Why are you here? I ask.
I'm a family liaison officer.
A what?
I've been assigned to look after you.
I want to talk to your boss.
DCS McAteer isn't at the hospital yet.
I try to sit up. Lisa Jane puts a pillow behind my back. I'm still wearing a hospital gown and can feel the pressure on my stitches, which are bandaged beneath cotton gauze and tape.
My mobile phone, where is it?
I've been minding it, says Lisa Jane. We've been monitoring your messages.
Why?
In case you get any calls from the kidnapper.
Is that what happened? Did someone kidnap him? Do they want a ransom? We're not rich.
We have to consider every possibility.
She pulls my phone from her pocket and hands it to me. I cup it in my hands, feeling the residual warmth from her body. There are dozens of missed calls, mostly from my parents and Grace and other friends, but nothing from Jack. I call his number and let it ring. It goes to messages.
Where are you?
My voice breaks.
I need you.
I can't think of anything else to say. Ending the call, I stare at the phone.
Where could he be? Why isn't he here? I want his arms wrapped around me. I want to hear him say that everything will be all right. Who took my baby?
I whisper. We don't know, says Lisa Jane, taking a seat next to the bed.
She was dressed like a nurse.
We don't believe she worked here.
But the uniform
could have been stolen.
Someone knocks softly. Lisa Jane goes to the door and answers, not opening it fully. She turns.
Your parents are here. Do you want to see them?
Can you give me a few minutes? I need a hairbrush and a mirror.
Lisa Jane fetches them from the adjoining bathroom. I tilt the mirror, studying different parts of my face, but not the whole. My eyes look bruised, as though I've seen too much or slept too little. Brushing my hair into some semblance of order, I pinch my cheeks, hoping to raise some colour. My parents are ushered in, their eyes telling the story. My mother squeaks my name and hurries to my bedside, pulling me into her arms, hugging me like a child with an earache. I spy my father standing behind her, saying nothing, looking helpless. Now in his mid-60s, he has always taken pride in his family, having provided for them and kept them safe. This has shaken him. This wasn't foreseen. Letting go of my mother, I hug him in the same way, allowing myself to be enfolded in his arms, pressing my face against his chest where I catch the scent of Old Spice and Imperial leather. The tears come from childhood. I sob and shake. He strokes my hair and whispers my name. Now it's my mother's turn to feel left out.
"Where are the kids?"
I ask, wiping my eyes.
"Grace is looking after them," says my mother. "What have you told them?"
"Nothing. Lucy keeps asking."
"Have you seen Jack?"
"No."
"He's not answering his phone."
"I think he's helping with the search," says Dad. As if on cue, we hear a commotion in the corridor outside. Jack appears. He's wearing the same clothes as yesterday or perhaps the day before, disheveled, unshaven, exhausted. He drops to his knees beside the bed and rests his head on my lap.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry," he says plaintively.
His eyes are bloodshot and he reeks of sweat and dirt and fear.
"Where have you been?"
I ask. "Driving. Walking. I thought... I wanted... I hoped..." He stops and starts, but can't finish.
"I've been looking everywhere. But it's only when you start that you realize how many streets there are in London. How many houses."
I stroke his unwashed hair.
"You should get some sleep."
"I have to find him."
"Leave it to the police."
"It's my fault. I should have looked at her ID. I should have gone with her."
He shudders.
"I'm so sorry. I didn't know. I thought she said I could go with her. I should have gone."
"It's not your fault," I say blankly. But inside I'm screaming, "You gave our baby to some stranger. She could be a child molester or a monster. You didn't want another child, so you gave our baby away." I'm torn between wanting to comfort him and to punish him, to forgive and to blame. I want to play the victim, but Jack seems to have usurped that role. Everybody feels sorry for him, my mother, my father, the policewoman. In my head, I shout at him,
"For Christ's sake, Jack, this is not about you."
Swallowing my anger, I stroke his hair and tell him to go home, to sleep. "The police want to talk to us," he says. Lisa Jane corrects him. "They've already interviewed you, Mr. Shaughnessy. They want to talk to your wife alone." "Why?" "It's normal procedure."
"Normal? There's nothing normal about this. I want to know what the police are doing."
I turn to Mum and Dad and ask them to take Jack home. I tell him we'll talk later, but he's still complaining as they usher him outside. Two detectives are waiting to see me. Chairs are found and pulled into place, one on either side of my bed. It feels more like a bedside arraignment than an interview. The man in charge hands me his card. I study it closely, giving myself time to gather my thoughts. Detective Chief Superintendent Brendan McAteer has blue eyes, pale eyelashes, and a face so chiseled and angular that the skin looks stretched over his bones. His freckles have faded but must riot every summer across his nose and cheeks. I wonder how much he was teased in his youth. What nicknames did he suffer? The other detective is overweight and block-headed, with eyes that are too small for his skull. I don't catch his name, but he rarely speaks, preferring to take notes and occasionally exchange glances with McAteer. The detectives sit with their shoulders canted forward. The only sounds are the creak of the chairs and rustle of clothing. Firstly, they reassure me that everything that can be done is being done to find my baby. DCS McAteer's lips barely move as he speaks, but at the same time his eyes keep darting over me with a strange intensity, as though he's putting me together like a jigsaw puzzle. Unfolding a plan of the hospital, he points out the maternity ward and the various corridors, stairwells and lifts.
The bogus nurse left the recovery ward through these doors, pushing a wheelchair. She took a lift to the fifth floor. A hospital cleaner saw a nurse matching the description of the abductor at about 8:15 p.m. She was carrying something tucked under her right arm. The cleaner didn't get a good look at the woman's face, but we're hoping to talk to a plumber who was working on that floor.
He produces a grainy color photograph taken from a CCTV camera. It shows the woman from an oblique angle, slightly behind and above.
We have enhanced the images, but none of the footage has provided a clear image of her face. Technicians are still working to see if they can make improvements. Do you remember seeing her?
No. What about facial recognition software?
The technology is only effective if we can find a clear image of the suspect. Equally, we may discover this woman has never been arrested or come to our attention, which means she won't be in our database. In the meantime, I've arranged for a police sketch artist to sit down with your husband and the cleaner. Hopefully, we can come up with a good likeness. In the meantime, we've issued a description of her as white, 30 to 45, 5'8" to 5'10", pale complexion, medium build and dark hair. At this point, we haven't been able to identify anyone matching this woman's description arriving or leaving the hospital, which suggests she may have had other disguises.
Could she still be here? I ask.
That's unlikely. The alarm was raised within 10 minutes and the hospital went into lockdown. Security guards stopped anyone leaving. Staff searched room by room. Police stopped traffic outside and talked to pedestrians.
McAteer leans forward, resting his hands on his knees.
It's also possible she had an accomplice, which could explain how she evaded security. Right now, we are focusing on identifying everyone who entered and left the hospital in the hours before the abduction and immediately afterwards.
She wore a nurse's uniform,
which suggests a high degree of planning rather than a random spur-of-the-moment act.
Is that a good thing?
Most likely it means she really wanted a baby and will take good care of him. Equally, it could make her harder to find because she will cover her tracks.
Over the next 20 minutes, I am taken back over the events, the birth, the aftermath, going for a shower, coming back to find an empty crib.
Have you talked to your husband about that night? The DCS asks.
Yes. Why?
Did he tell you where he went after he left the hospital?
I falter for a moment. He said he was looking for the nurse?
McAteer glances at his colleague, and something unspoken seems to pass between them. Have you thought about a name for the baby? He asks.
We haven't decided.
This is already a big news story. Public interest will be high, and it would help if we had a name. It allows the media to personalize the story, to focus on an actual baby instead of a nameless one.
You want us to name the baby now?
You can always change it later, come up with a new one.
I understand his reasoning, but it doesn't seem right to name a child that I cannot hold. We were thinking of calling him Benjamin, Ben for short. That's nice, says Lisa Jane, who has been sitting in the corner.
So it's Baby Ben, says McAteer. The media will like that. What about photographs?
Jack took some.
With your permission, I'd like to release one photograph immediately and hold the others back.
I scroll through images on my phone, and we choose one of Ben swaddled in a cotton blanket, his face scrunched up and his eyes half open, struggling against the unexpected brightness. I'm also in the photograph. The C-section took the hard work out of labor, and I had energy left to smile.
We're also going to need a comment from you.
I don't want to talk to anyone, I say.
I understand. I'll have a press officer draft something for you.
McAteer gets to his feet. Is that all? I ask. He smiles, trying to reassure me.
Cases like this are normally solved quite quickly. A new baby doesn't go unnoticed. Someone will contact us. A friend, family member or neighbor. I'm confident of that.
I don't want to stay in hospital.
The doctors insist that you do.
I'm not taking any more sedatives.
It will help you rest.
It will affect my breast milk. I want to be able to feed Ben when you find him.
Talk to your doctor,
It's a medical decision.
Agatha. Rory wakes at 5 in the spectral light, snuffling and gurgling. Rain streaks the window, throwing patterns on his face and across the white sheets. Leaving Hayden to sleep, I warm a bottle and sit with Rory on the sofa, stroking his cheek and looking into his eyes. I like this time of day when I have Rory to myself. I have everything I ever wanted, here and now under this roof. Yet I alternate between anguish and euphoria, as though I'm living 2 different lives at once, each within earshot of the other. So far, Hayden hasn't questioned my reasons for not breastfeeding Rory in front of him. I explained about cracked nipples and mastitis, and said I couldn't provide Rory with enough breast milk, so a midwife suggested I supplement his feeds with formula. "I'm still expressing," I say to Hayden, showing him the breast pump. "Don't tell your mother about me having problems." "Why not?" he asks. "I feel guilty."
"She won't mind."
"Other mothers get quite funny about that sort of thing. Judgmental."
He looks at me sheepishly. "I might have mentioned it already. She asked how things were going."
"And you told her?"
"I said you were giving him bottles."
"Oh, now she'll think I'm a terrible mother."
"No, she won't."
Hayden is besotted with Rory. It's amazing how men happily turn into clowns around babies, blowing raspberries into tummies, pulling faces and making up new words, desperate to get some reaction. More confident now, he knows how to hold Rory properly, and I've taught him how to make up bottles and test the temperature of the milk by shaking droplets onto his inner wrist. On top of all this, he's been extra attentive towards me, making me cups of tea and running errands. "You haven't changed a nappy yet," I said yesterday. "I'll do the next one," he replied. Later I called out, "Hey, you're up, sailor boy."
"I meant the next baby," he laughed,
and I felt my chest swell. We're taking loads of photographs. Rory with Hayden, Rory with me, Rory with Mr. and Mrs. Cole, Hayden and me and Rory. I'll get the best ones framed and put on the mantelpiece. Rory takes almost a whole bottle, and I burp him on my shoulder. Hayden emerges from the bedroom, scratching his navel. I like that he's shaved off his beard. He's nicer to kiss, and I can see the strong line of his jaw. His eyes light up when he sees Rory.
"Hey, watch this," he says,
leaning close to Rory and poking out his tongue. A beat passes, and Rory's tongue comes out, mimicking him.
"I taught him that," he says. "The kid is a genius."
He turns on the TV. The story of missing baby Ben is leading every bulletin. TV reporters are crossing live from outside the Churchill Hospital, interviewing patients and passers-by, and members of staff who say they're not allowed to comment. "Those poor people. They must be worried sick," says Hayden, who is standing behind me, massaging my shoulders. I murmur in agreement. On screen, a detective is issuing an appeal for assistance.
"On Thursday the 7th of December, at about 7:50 p.m., a woman entered the Singleton ward of Churchill Hospital, central London. Posing as a nurse, she took away Ben Shaughnessy, who was born earlier that day. The woman is described as being between 30 and 45 years old, 5 feet 8 to 5 feet 10 inches tall, with a medium build, brown eyes, fair complexion and dark hair, which may have been a wig." The scene changes, and I see blurry footage of myself walking down a corridor, keeping my head down. A second clip shows me waiting at the lift. I raise my hand and shield my face. It has been enhanced, but the quality is so poor that my face looks almost pixelated.
"Do you know her?" asks the detective. "Could she be a friend or a neighbor? Do you know anyone who has unexpectedly returned home with a baby? If you can help, please contact Crime Stoppers. All information will be treated in strict confidence."
The detective pauses and picks up a sheet of paper.
"Mr. and Mrs. Shaughnessy have asked me to thank the public for the many messages of support. They provided this comment. Ben was just 10 hours old when he was taken. We held him only briefly, but his loss has torn out our hearts. Please give him back.
Take him to a church or a school, or leave him at a police station. Give him to someone in authority. Please, please, give him back to us. A photograph appears on screen, showing Meg propped up on pillows, holding a baby on her chest. It must have been taken immediately after the birth.
I know her,
I whisper. Hayden hesitates. What?
The mother. She goes to my yoga class. I went to her house a few weeks ago. She gave me some spare baby clothes.
Hayden walks around the sofa and sits down. What's she like?
She has two other children, Lucy and Lachlan. I used to see her all the time when I worked at the supermarket.
Why didn't you say before?
They didn't release her name straight away.
I pick up my mobile phone and scroll through the email messages until I find one from Meg.
There you are. I sent her a photograph of Rory and she replied.
When was that?
Before she went into hospital.
You should send her another message,
Hayden says. And say what?
I don't know. Say you're praying for her.
Isn't that being cruel? It will just remind her that my baby is safe and well, and her baby is missing.
Hayden considers this. Maybe you're right.
She has two other children, I say. They'll keep her busy, and I bet she sues that hospital for millions.
That's not the point, though, is it?
Says Hayden.
I lean my head against his shoulder and mesh my fingers with his, brushing my thumb over the hairs on the back of his hand.
You're right. I'll wait until she gets home from hospital and give her a call.
Megan. 48 hours have passed, the critical time frame. If a missing person isn't found or a crime isn't solved, or a suspect isn't charged within 2 days, the chance of success begins to diminish. I'm sure I've read that somewhere or seen it on TV. Ben has been gone for longer than that. Annie and Lisa Jane, my police liaison officers, are taking turns sitting with me. They're running defense, keeping the reporters at bay, answering my phone, reading messages and vetting visitors. The hospital has transferred me to a different room, away from the maternity ward, so as not to upset other women who are having babies. I'm like a body that has to be removed quickly from an accident scene, or a mistake that has to be hushed up. Pretending to be asleep, I hear the squeak of the nurse's shoes and the clatter of a trolley in the corridor outside, the singing of telephones and the droning of the intercom. My imagination projects images on my closed eyelids. I keep seeing Ben being nursed by someone else. Either that, or I picture him abandoned on a mountainside, like Oedipus, or set adrift like the infant Moses. At other times, I imagine that I can communicate with him telepathically, not because we share the same DNA, but because I carried him inside me for 9 months. We shared blood and nutrients. We listened to each other's hearts. He heard my voice. You cannot break a bond like that by clamping and cutting a cord, or by stealing a baby from his mother. With each new change of shift, I ask the same question. Has there been any news?
No news is good news, replies Annie.
How can no news be good news?
It means that whoever took your baby hasn't panicked and dumped him. She's taken him home. She'll keep him safe. She'll look after him.
I think of Madeline McCann, the little girl who disappeared in Portugal and has never been found. What if that happens to us? What if they never find Ben? Are we going to spend the rest of our lives wondering, waiting for a knock on the door or a phone call to say that he's alive or dead? Annie keeps reminding me that babies are resilient. The doctors say the same thing. One of them told me a story yesterday about a baby who survived in the rubble of an earthquake for 10 days.
Why are you talking about earthquakes? I wanted to say. What does that have to do with anything?
Annie and Lisa Jane are supposed to get as many details from me as possible. In practice, it means they keep asking me the same questions over and over until I get annoyed. Do I have any enemies? Did I notice anyone hanging around the corridors of the hospital? Meanwhile, outside of these walls, Ben has become more than a name. He is a brand now, a product to sell newspapers and boost ratings. The alliteration works well in headlines. Baby Ben, every mother's nightmare. Baby Ben, three more sightings. White van seized in hunt for Baby Ben. Baby Ben, how did he disappear? Jack shares my uncertainty, but we each pretend otherwise. He sits beside my bed, or we go downstairs to the cafe. He's frustrated at the lack of progress, constantly asking why the police aren't busting down doors and taking down names. He wants to see posters in every shop window and to hear them shouting Ben's name from the rooftops. I am trying so hard not to blame him. I am fighting against the idea, knowing its wrongness and irrationality, but I cannot help myself. He gave our baby to a stranger. He watched someone carry Ben away. Annie is sitting at a nearby table, giving us some privacy. She's keeping watch for any reporters who may have sneaked into the hospital, looking for an interview or photographs. They're camped outside, dozens of them, sending me letters and notes via nurses and orderlies, offering us money for an exclusive interview. One of the cleaners was caught trying to slip into my room with a disposable camera hidden in his pocket. Jack and I are sitting at a booth, saying nothing. He has torn the top from a sachet of sugar and poured the contents on the plastic table, pushing the grains into small mounds with his forefinger. I wish I could comfort him. I wish he could comfort me. Two men approach wearing dark grey suits, white shirts and silk ties.
I'm Patrick Carmody, says the younger man, director of hospital services.
Thomas Glenorg, says the other one, handing Jack his business card.
I cannot express how sincerely and deeply sorry we are for what's happened, says Mr. Carmody. I am personally shocked and saddened that a newborn baby could be taken from this hospital, despite our state-of-the-art security system. Please accept my personal apology. Neither of us answers. Mr. Carmody glances at the other man and continues.
The Churchill is cooperating fully with the police, giving them access to our cameras, our staff, our records. If there is anything else that you feel you need, please let us know.
He could resign, says Jack, deadpan. Mr. Carmody laughs nervously before recovering his composure.
As well as helping the police, we are reviewing our security. The hospital board has reacted swiftly, approving identity bracelets and movement sensors to prevent this sort of thing from ever happening.
This sort of thing, says Jack, mimicking Carmody's accent.
I rather think that horse has bolted, don't you? He's thrown the jockey, kicked down the barn door, and he's out of sight.
The administrator tries again. I understand you're upset, Mr. Shaughnessy. You have every right to be. We have a proud history at the Churchill. We have delivered thousands of babies, and nothing like this has ever happened before. We have very robust security protocols, but no system is foolproof.
You're wrong, replies Jack, interrupting him. A maternity hospital should be completely foolproof, so that no fool can walk out with someone else's baby.
The other man finally speaks.
The Churchill is not your enemy, Mr. Shaughnessy.
Jack glances at the business card he was given.
You're a lawyer.
My firm represents the hospital.
You're frightened that we're going to sue.
That's not the reason that we've...
You're worried about how much money this is going to cost you.
We wish to express our sorrow and sympathy, says Mr. Carmody. Jack points to the lawyer.
Did he brief you beforehand, tell you what to say?
I don't think this is helpful. Jack pushes back his chair.
Get out!
Please don't raise your voice, says the lawyer.
You want me to be quiet?
Asks Jack, doing the opposite.
Our baby was taken from your hospital by someone wearing one of your nursing uniforms, walking past your guards, your security cameras, and you want me to stay quiet? Fuck you!
For a moment, I think Jack might punch him. Instead, he flicks the business card onto the floor.
Don't come near us again. From now on, you talk to our lawyer.
DCS McAteer has come back to see me. I'm out of bed and moving without pain, and the doctor says I can go home tomorrow.
We're talking in the patient lounge, which has a TV, several sofas, and a wall of vending machines selling snacks and soft drinks. McAteer counts out his loose change and buys me a can of lemonade that clatters into the metal tray.
I'm sorry, I don't have a glass.
That's okay. We sit. I sip. The detective speaks.
We've been over the CCTV footage and believe we have identified how the kidnapper got in and out of the hospital.
He opens the flap of an envelope and produces a photograph showing a woman in an oversized coat pulling a wheel-along tartan trolley across the foyer. A second image is of a man with a long grey ponytail wearing overalls and a baseball cap.
Remember I said we were looking for a plumber who was working the fifth floor at about the time Ben was taken?
Did you find him?
No.
I don't understand.
We know a woman entered the hospital wheeling a tartan trolley, but we have found no evidence of her leaving. All of which begs the question, how did she get Ben out of the hospital?
McAteer puts two photographs side by side.
According to the security cameras, we have a woman kidnapper who didn't leave the hospital, and an unidentified plumber who didn't arrive. This points to the strong possibility that we're dealing with the same person dressed in different disguises.
I study the images again. At first glance, at any glance, they look like completely different people.
The genius is in the detail, says McAteer. We found traces of makeup in a wash basin on the fifth floor, and a single contact lens on the floor.
But where is Ben?
We believe he was placed in the trolley. My hand finds my mouth.
He'll suffocate.
No, there's plenty of air.
McAteer shows me another photograph taken by a CCTV camera at the hospital's loading dock. It shows the plumber walking away from the camera heading towards the street, still pulling the dark-coloured trolley.
We've enhanced the footage, but this is the best we can do.
They're unrecognisable.
Yes, but now that we know about the second disguise, we can look for clearer images from cameras in the area and re-interview witnesses. In the meantime, there's something you can do for me. I want to arrange a media conference for you and Jack. We need you to make a further appeal.
What does Jack say?
He's agreed.
I nod.
Before then, I'd like you to talk to a psychologist who has worked with the police before. I've asked him to draw up a psychological profile to give us a better idea of who we're dealing with.
A profile?
He can help understand what might be going through this woman's mind, or how she'll react to the media coverage. His name is Cyrus Haven, and he's the very best.
Agatha. Let's go out, says Hayden. Where?
We'll take Rory for a walk.
But it's cold outside.
The fresh air will do him good. Come on. I'm getting cabin fever in here.
You're a sailor.
You know what I mean.
I strap Rory into his pram and tuck a snuggly blanket around him before we push him along New King's Road to Parsons Green. Hayden orders a pint from the White Horse, and we sit outside at a table, enjoying the weak winter sunshine. Hayden sees someone he knows and introduces me as his fiancée. I feel warm and tingly inside, as though I've downed a double vodka and cranberry, even though I haven't touched a drop. Someone has left a copy of the Metro on the table. Hayden spreads it beneath his pint glass. Baby Ben has filled the first four pages, and newspapers are competing to see who can whip up the most interest. The Daily Express offered a reward of £50,000, only to be topped by the Daily Mirror's £100,000. Until the Sun trumped them both with £250,000.
They're wasting their money, says Hayden.
Why do you say that?
Baby Ben's long gone.
You think he's dead?
I didn't say that.
What then?
I reckon he was probably stolen to order. Some rich couple or Arab sheikh wanted a baby boy, so he had one stolen.
Why wouldn't they just buy one?
You can't just buy a baby, scoffs Hayden. Sounding like an expert, I bet whoever took Ben has already smuggled him out of the country, probably bribed someone at immigration, or flew him out on a private jet. He looks back at the Metro, whistling at the reward. We could do with that sort of money.
We're okay.
We could buy a house.
My flat's big enough.
Not for long. He pinches my bum. What about the other babies?
I laugh. One at a time, sailor boy. Across the road on Parsons Green, mothers or nannies are sitting on park benches, watching toddlers toddle and babies crawl and children ride scooters along the tarmac paths. Many of the women are wearing matching sweatshirts. I look more closely. Each top features the photograph of a baby, beneath the words, "Where is baby Ben?" Across the back is the sponsor's name, the Daily Mail.
"Have you noticed how people are staring at us?" I say. Hayden puts down his pint glass.
"What do you mean?"
"They look at Rory, and I can see them thinking, you know, wondering if we've stolen him."
"But we didn't steal him."
"I know, but you look at that mother over there. The one under the tree. Who's to say if that's her baby? It could be baby Ben."
"I told you. Baby Ben is long gone. He's out of the country by now."
"What if he's not?"
"Think about it," he says. "He was taken, what, 3 days ago? If he were still in this country, someone would have noticed. You can't just bring a strange baby home. Neighbours would hear him crying or notice her buying nappies. It can't be easy to hide a baby."
He reaches into the pram and puts his entire hand over Rory's chest.
"But we should keep a close eye on our little fella, in case somebody tries to steal him."
"You don't think they would?"
"I'm kidding." He drains his glass and belches.
"One more for the road."
He goes to the bar. Reaching into the pram, I stroke Rory's cheek. With each passing day, I feel more assured of his place in the world. He's taken root in my heart, anchoring himself to me. I am his mother now. He reaches out for me. He longs for my touch. I'm sure Hayden feels the same way. Some men get funny about babies because they think a woman only has a finite amount of love to give. But it's not about dividing or subtracting or making do with less. Our hearts expand. We have double the love, maybe more. Hayden is back, nursing a fresh pint. Making conversation, he asks me where I was born and raised, wanting to know about my mother. I should be flattered by his interest, but I don't want him turning over rocks and peering underneath. At the same time, I don't want to appear evasive or secretive. I have to give him something. So I mention Elijah being killed on his way to school. Hayden wants all the details. Did I see it happen? Did I blame myself?
"Why should I blame myself?" I snap. "It wasn't my fault."
"Okay, okay," says Hayden, holding up his hands. "Jesus, I was only making conversation."
I apologize. He goes quiet. I ask him if he always wanted to join the Navy.
"Hell no. I was keeping a promise."
"How?"
"I had a mate called Michael Murray, and one day we each cut our right thumbs, mixed the blood, and made a promise that when we grew up we'd join the Navy.
Like blood brothers?"
"Yeah."
"Did he do it?"
"Course not. He sells vacuum cleaners for his old man."
"But you kept your promise."
"I sort of had to."
"Why?"
"I had a few problems with the police when I was 16 and finished up in court. My solicitor told the magistrates that I was hoping to join the Royal Navy. A criminal conviction would make it difficult. The magistrates gave me a caution and let me go. After that, I felt obliged to follow through."
"What were you charged with?"
"Criminal damage."
"What did you damage?"
"I set fire to a teacher's car. He was an arsehole."
"I'm shocked."
Hayden looks at me sheepishly. "You must have done something terrible when you were younger."
"Never."
"I bet you did. I bet you're keeping it a secret. I'm going to get in touch with your mum and find out exactly what you were like."
That statement rattles something inside me, and I feel the creature begin stirring, pushing aside my organs.
"I've upset you," says Hayden.
"What did I say?" "It doesn't matter."
"Is it the questions?"
"I'm interested. Rory needs to be fed."
"You could breastfeed him."
"I'm still too sore."
Buttoning my coat and releasing the brake, I steer the pram between tables and onto the pavement. Hayden hurriedly finishes his pint and jogs to catch up with me. We walk in silence.
"You should get one of those sweatshirts," he says.
"Huh?"
"The baby Ben tops. Nobody will stare at you then."
Megan. The psychologist is younger than I expect, in his mid-30s, dressed in a long-sleeved cotton shirt buttoned at the throat and loose-fitting jeans. Tall and lean, with prominent cheekbones and eyelashes that most women would kill for, he looks like a college student trying to save on haircuts. Cyrus Haven shakes my hand, holding it a second longer than is comfortable while he seems to study me. I've heard it said that a person's eyes are the only things that do not age on the face. They are no less bright on the first day than their last day. The doctor's eyes are pale blue, with pupils blacker than charcoal. "May I sit here?" he asks. "It's the only chair," I say. He laughs and agrees. I wonder if he's nervous too. We're in my private room at the hospital, where the curtains are open on a grey London day. My suitcase is half-packed, lying open on the bed. Jack is coming to take me home in a few hours. Cyrus takes a yellow legal pad from a satchel that has been hanging off his shoulder. He searches for a pen, opening the many pockets until he finds one, and holds it up triumphantly. He scribbles something on the page, but the pen doesn't work. He shakes it a few times and tries again. Nothing. "I can ask a nurse." "No, it's fine," he says, putting the pad away. He takes out a folded white handkerchief, shakes it open, and begins cleaning his wire-framed glasses. I wonder if this whole routine is part of a performance. He's pretending to be forgetful and preoccupied so that my defenses will be lowered. The silence expands. "Would you like a cup of tea?" I ask. "No, thank you." Cyrus places his glasses on his nose and adjusts them. He's handsome in a disheveled, obviously English way, and reminds me of a tutor that I had at university. He was Cyrus's age, and I was a lot younger. But like a lot of students, boys and girls, I had a crush on him. For some reason, the tutor seemed to call on me more than the others. I was flattered. I even fantasized about him because he was clever and accomplished, with ungovernable dark hair and a small cleft in the center of his chin that I wanted to touch with my tongue to see how deep it went. One day, he invited me to his rooms. I accepted. I thought he might make a pass at me, a notion that terrified and excited me. But instead, he handed me an unbound proof of his latest novel, asking if I would read it for him because I had a good eye. "A good eye?" I asked. "You're strong on grammar and spelling." The memory makes me cringe with embarrassment. Cyrus has been watching me. "How are you sleeping?"
"They give me pills."
"Are you eating?"
"You've been talking to the nurses."
"They're worried about you." He notices a framed photograph of Lucy and Lachlan in my open suitcase and asks me their names. Half an hour later, I realize that I'm still talking. Imperceptibly, he has drawn me into a one-sided conversation, learning where I was born and went to school, about my parents and sister and Jack. Soon I'm telling him about buying the house in Barnes and falling pregnant again. I don't mention the arguments, or the doubts, or the one-night stand with Simon. He has a soft voice that washes through our discussion, nudging it in different directions or exploring new corners. I can't remember the last time I revealed so much to a man like this, a stranger. Eventually, we reach the present. Cyrus knows the general details of the abduction and has seen the CCTV footage, but he wants me to recount the story again. He explains the nature of cognitive interviewing, how it can help people recall more of what they've been through. "There's no pressure. Relax. Lie back. Close your eyes. Tell me about the birth. Imagine you're a film director, trying to recreate the moment, telling people where to stand and what to say." I do as he says, describing the caesarean, how Jack made me laugh. For a long while, he didn't want a third child, but he took one look at Ben and melted. By 11 o'clock, I told Cyrus, we were back in the shared ward. I slept for a few hours, woke, ate lunch, and slept again. Jack called my parents and Grace, telling them the good news. My parents came to see me during visiting hours. Grace was looking after Lucy and Lachlan.
When you went for a shower, did you notice anyone in the ward?
No.
Picture the scene.